Welcome to session four of the Yoga Sutra Book Study Club, Practice of the Yoga Sutra. This session is Unveiling the Mystery of Purusha and Prakriti, chapter 2, verses 17 to 27. Last session, we ended on a very definitive statement, Sutra 2.16, that pain which has not yet come can be abandoned. And that really followed from an extensive discussion on the nature of karma, which itself was an extension of our discussion on the kleshas. So it's important to kind of take measure of where we've come from, that the root of suffering is these five kleshas, five afflictions of ignorance, distorted sense of self-identity, attachment, aversion, and ultimately a fear of losing our identity, fear of death. And these afflictions are the deeper cause behind our mind's roaming tendencies. And when they motivate our mind to engage with the world, that kind of engagement of the mind, that kind of vritti, leads to innumerable impressions in our mind, samskaras, that have similar qualities as the kleshas. And really what that means is that it creates a dynamic where we often return to similar patterns, patterns that have those tendencies of affliction. And that's really what we explored in depth in the law of karma last session. That this law of karma is not meant to be like a punishment that we've been born with, but rather it's helping us understand how we've created the reality that we live in. A reality which is both has the seeds of pleasure or contentment and the seeds of pain. And that's exactly where we left. 2.15 was a statement that can be a little bit disconcerting, that for a wise person, everything is pain. But it's important to see what the words after that were. Everything is painful because our expectations are not realistic. Everything changes. Everything has, and we don't want it to change. There's seeds of our own inner turmoil inbuilt in much of the experiences of the world. And ultimately, pain, in the way that Yoga Sutra is defining it, is anything other than complete fulfillment. So many states might not appear to be painful at face value, but they don't hold the potential for our complete fulfillment. And that's where this definition of the word wise person is so interesting. And we'll come back to the word which is used here. Viveki is the word which is used for wise person. And we'll come back at the very end of today's session to a word which is very much connected to this. Viveka Khyati, a state of unshakable discernment. So once we begin to see ourselves and see the world more clearly, we realize that the seeds of pain, either in a dormant form or in a full-blown, fully germinated version, are present. And as a wise person, we're seeking an experience that's completely opposite to pain, which is where we ended. That once we realize there's pain in life, what we have to do is skillfully find a path that allows us to make sure that we don't encounter that again in the future. The past is the past. It can't be undone. All we can do is learn a lesson. But we have tremendous freedom of will, freedom of choice, to create a future that we want, future free of pain. And that's exactly the last sutra that we covered, 2.16. From here, we begin an exploration of how do we really put that into practice? How do we avoid pain and cultivate those qualities which allow us to transcend our afflictions and ultimately, which through the process of transcending these afflictions, allow us to experience our essential self, to be fulfilled at every level. We need to know why there's pain. And we need to know something about the reality that we've been born into. So this next set of sutras has a lot to do with a yogic understanding of the universe, both in a cosmic sense and our personal world. How does our personal world come into being? What are its building blocks? And what is the relationship between our world and what we might call higher reality? A reality that is intrinsically free from suffering, a reality which holds full extent of human potential. A reality that allows us to transform our attitude towards ourself and towards our manifest world. 217 is again a little bit cryptic. It says that the union of the seer and the seeable is the cause of pain. What does that mean? And this word seer, we've used this word in the past to represent pure consciousness. How is it that we're saying that anything to do with pure consciousness can be the cause of our pain? That seems to go completely contrary to what we've been studying. It's very important to look at what we mean by seer and seeable. For all intents and purposes, we consider ourselves to be the seer. We are the center of our own universe. And from our perspective, we are the perceiver. We are the doer. The world does revolve around us. It's not because we have any sense of extraordinarily inflated ego. From our perspective, we're seeing the world purely from our perspective, and we know that. And the seeable that's being referred to here is our life, our world. Our ability to understand ourselves is completely in context to how we see ourselves in the world. Whether, and I mean primarily in the external world, all of the experiences of life, but even our inner world, all of our personality traits, our hopes and aspirations, the things we like and the things we dislike, kleshas. All of that is the seeable. It's our personal world. And there is a complete union, a very powerful, definitive integration between ourself as the seer, the knower, the one who is engaged, and everything that revolves around us. It's like it's one and the same. When we try to imagine ourselves outside of any other context of the world or our inner life, it's impossible. There's no way of knowing what are we. Only thing we can say is that that's nothingness. It's like deep sleep or death. If I don't understand myself in context to whatever I already know, what am I? So this union of the seer and the seeable is not just an intellectual or theoretical thing. It's reality. This is our present reality, I should say. Now, why is it the cause of pain? It's exactly the reasons that were listed in 215. It talked about everything being subject to change, distress, karmic impressions, and mutually contradicting forces of nature. We went into those in quite great detail. Essentially, this union of ourself with an individual awareness and the world is one where we're trying to seek a complete fulfillment from every experience that we have, from every identity that we have. And yet, all of those experiences are fleeting. And they're all very much like fragments of reality. We're trying to see something infinitely vast, one small sliver at a time. And it's very unfulfilling. When we find something that we like, we really hold on to it, and it never lasts. When we bump into something that we don't like, we're very concerned. And concern might be a mild way of putting it, petrified about encountering it again. And all of life is a continual struggle for survival. It might sound very dire, but really what this is talking about is that these kleshas, these afflictions, are like the fabric with which our life, from which our life is woven right now. That every part of our life in some way is influenced by these afflictions. So when we as an individual seed of awareness, focal point of awareness, are fully tied into this reality, what the sutra is calling a union of ourself and our seeable reality, there's only one possible outcome, and that is that it's an experience of these kleshas. If we're trying to transcend the kleshas, we need to see ourselves in some other way. Now, the sutra is very intriguing when we look at another alternative definition of seer and seeable, because that's exactly what the rest of this cluster of sutras is really talking about. If we see, if we're interpreting the sutra to say that the union of pure consciousness and primordial nature, the union of Purusha and Prakriti, two words that we've encountered before and will encounter again very soon, is the cause of pain, it basically says that this entire reality, this creation, is nothing more than a big field of pain. So why were we even here in the first place? And what good is that kind of Purusha, consciousness, and Prakriti, primordial nature, said to be field of limitless potential, creative intelligence? What good is that if their union results in pain? And this is where the sutra has been kind of misinterpreted or mispositioned in many regards. The commentary that we're studying goes directly to this point, that the union of Purusha and Prakriti is not the cause of pain. Union of pure consciousness and the power of consciousness is absolutely not what this sutra is referring to. It's the union of our personal identity and our personal world, which is the cause of our pain in a very personal way. And life is all about trying to find a balance and reorient ourselves so that we look for the right thing in the right place, work with these kleshas, and transform them. The union of Purusha and Prakriti is perfection. And that's exactly where this delves into, that the very essential self-nature of Prakriti is fulfillment. Prakriti is this infinitely vast, rich field of potential, creative intelligence that's fully aware of herself and is an opportunity for every single living being to find their completion. And Purusha is that primordial will that pulsates through this field of potential, that purpose, which intrinsically is all about fulfillment and freedom, that brings Prakriti into a manifest state. Prakriti is potential, and Purusha is that infallible willpower, desire, that every single living being finds their fulfillment and freedom. That union creates the universe. This universe is completely primed for every single living being to find their fulfillment. And absolutely, it's not a universe which is full of pain and which is like a minefield that we're looking to try to somehow find our way through and escape. If we were able to see into this universe without looking at it through the lens of our own samskaras, our own kleshas, we would see it for exactly what it is. And yet, we're not able to do so. And we'll continue delving into why. But it's very important, right before we get into everything else, to acknowledge very clearly that when we're studying the nature of Purusha and Prakriti and the universe that evolves from there, we're starting from a very empowered, positive place. We're not seeing that this universe is a prison. We're not seeing that pain or any sense of limitation is intrinsic to our universe. That's a conditioning of our own mind. But the universe that we're blessed with is a reflection of the infinitely vast potential of Prakriti and the infallible will of Purusha that all living beings find their fulfillment. And that fulfillment blossoms into a profound experience of freedom. That's where we should begin. Acknowledging that there is pain today because our world is too small. And we've chosen to live in our own personal world, which is constrained and defined and limited by our pre-existing identities, conditioned by the afflictions. But there is a bigger world that we're part of, where we can find freedom from all pain, all limitations. They both are completely side by side. And it's our opportunity to transform how we engage with the world so we can really experience that. 218 and 219 are like the heart of yoga metaphysics and yoga cosmology. And they really, in a very condensed way, help us understand this worldview that's underpinned by an ancient school of philosophy called Sankhya, that really is the metaphysical and philosophical foundation of yoga itself. 218 says, the objective world, composed of elements and senses, and having the inherent properties of illumination, action, and stability, has a twofold purpose, fulfillment and freedom. It's a very, very profound sutra that entire books have been written on. 218 and 219 can be expanded in a much bigger way. Let's break it down a little bit. When we talk about the objective world, it's the world of experience. Both the manifest world outside of us, our external world, and our inner world. Both of them are the objective reality. Everything that we can perceive. It's much, much bigger than we can imagine. It's not just the world of matter and energy, but it's a reality that is subtle as well, that underpins our world of matter and energy. Yoga doesn't distinguish between the two. That's why it says that this objective world is composed of elements and senses, meaning elements meaning those aspects which are the building blocks of reality, external reality, and all of the building blocks that allow us to perceive it, the senses. And we'll get into a little bit more detailed study of that. But our mind is as real as the external world, even though it's not made of the same building blocks. It's not tangible in the same way. It's not made of the five elements of the yoga and Sankhya worldview, or whatever number of 120 or something elements of the periodic table. It's not made of matter. And it's not even made of energy in the way that we understand energy, but the mind is equally real. We can't measure how big our mind is, but it's there. The mind is not just a byproduct of all of the biochemical reactions of the brain and whatever other magic of our neurology and physiology. Mind is more than matter and energy. And that something more is delineated in a very detailed way in yoga cosmology and yoga metaphysics. But the important thing here is to know that this entire objective world, both outside of ourself and the inner world of our mind, has the inherent properties of illumination, action, and stability. So there's three fundamental qualities called gunas that the entire world is comprised of, both the physical world and our subtle world. And it's interesting because these gunas are sattva, rajas, and tamas, three words that perhaps many of us have heard. But the Yoga Sutra is actually not using those three terms. It's using three corresponding terms. And these corresponding terms help us to understand the nature of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Because sattva and rajas and tamas are not like the material elements of our manifest world. They're qualities, intrinsic qualities of prakriti, primordial nature, which express themselves in infinitely diverse way to create what we call reality. It's hard to imagine that three qualities can arrange themselves in an infinitely diverse way, but that's exactly what's being said. And it's because these three qualities are very, very rich and nuanced. The first one is the property of illumination, sattva, that which allows anything to be known, perceived, understood. Second element, guna, is rajas, translated here as action. And the other Sanskrit word, which is actually what's being translated in the sutras, kriya, which is intriguing because we saw that word earlier. Kriya means the power of transformation. The second quality is the quality that allows anything of the world to continue transforming, manifesting, allowing a purpose to be fulfilled. And the third quality, stability, as is translated here, normally the Sanskrit word would be tamas. And the Sanskrit word that's used in this sutra, though, is sthitashilam, that which grounds every experience, that which brings it definition, tangibility, stability, as has been literally translated here. So these are three qualities called gunas, and there's a extraordinary interplay between these three qualities. It's like they're dancing with each other in an infinitely rich, diverse manner. And all of that diversity that comes from this manifests in the objective world. But all of it, all of our objective world, the world outside of us and the world within, all of it serves a twofold purpose: fulfillment and freedom. Bhoga and apavarga. So this sutra is one that we've already talked about, because again and again, I've used the phrase that life is the opportunity for our fulfillment and freedom. This is the classical source of that statement that's come up again and again in this commentary, and it's come up in the commentary of the first book of Secret of Yoga Sutra. It's a very profound and definitive statement that everything about our objective reality is for the achievement or for the experience of our fulfillment and freedom. That's the exact opposite of pain. We just said that there is pain, and the cause of that pain is a union of our personal mind with our personal world. We have forgotten that we're only a drop in the ocean, and there's a much bigger universe. And that universe is intrinsically endowed with every opportunity for our fulfillment and freedom. And once we can begin to experience that kind of world, our own personal world changes. And that's exactly what this whole study is all about. How can we transform our limited personal world, which is quite well defined by our afflictions, our kleshas, by our past samskaras, how we've already seen ourselves, how we've already conditioned our mind to see the world. How can we transform all of that so that we can live in this beautiful world that's being described here as having a twofold purpose of fulfillment and freedom? And these three inherent properties of sattva, rajas, and tamas are how we reach there. That this power of illumination, power of action, and power of stability, when brought to a point of balance, when purposefully engaged, allow us to find that fulfillment and freedom. It's not that only sattva, only illumination is required, but rather some unique relationship with all three of these gunas, qualities, that is perfectly resonant with the fulfillment that we're seeking is the key. So again, we're not trying to seek escape from this universe. We're trying to learn to be here fully in this beautiful, objective world, having these three qualities. Two 19 is equally dense. It's like even more dense. The total range of the gunas, these three qualities that comprise all of objective reality, is divided into four categories: specific, unspecific, barely describable, and absolutely indescribable. For most of us, this sutra is completely useless, doesn't tell us anything. And there's a few important things that we'll call out here. Sankhya is known, in fact, the literal meaning of Sankhya is to enumerate. So Sankhya is very famous for its articulation of this evolution, spiritual evolution of the universe, how this infinitely vast field of potential called Prakriti, which is comprised of these three qualities that we just talked about, how it manifests into 23 evolutes. And those 23 evolutes form our objective world, both the world outside of us, but much, much more emphasis actually is given on how the evolution of our inner world takes place, our mind and senses. And that's really what these four categories are all about. The specific that they're referring to here is the world that we're really familiar with. The world, external world, made up of the five gross elements: earth, water, air, fire, and space. It's whatever we understand our material reality to be, a world of matter and energy. And it's intriguing in that the specific also, so it's the world of matter and energy and our senses. Whatever is used to perceive this material world and to engage with it. Our capacity to see, smell, taste, touch, and hear are the senses of cognition that bring knowledge in. And then five senses which allow us to respond or to engage with the world. Sense of speech, physical manipulation, movement, procreation, and elimination. And the master sense of manas that coordinates all these 10 senses and brings them to a point of coherency. All of that is the specific because it's what allows us to be in the external world. And it's a reference point of how we can begin to look within. These 11 senses can either flow out into the world or they can flow in. And that's where the other three categories really come into play. It talks about a rich, a tremendous richness of our inner reality. And it starts going into a study of how our mind is a living reality, as real as the world outside of us. And there's a few definitive aspects of that that are important to keep in mind. First is this evolute of ahamkara, ego, capacity for identification. It's one of the fundamental building blocks of our inner world. That is what creates our personal world. How is it that we construct a world of our choice? Ahamkara, ego, employs the senses to experience. And every single experience that we encounter is claimed as the personal property of our ego. It's my experience. I either liked it or I didn't like it. The ahamkara, the ego, sees all of these experiences through the lens of our kleshas, our afflictions, and assigns some relative value on those experiences, and most importantly, says that this experience is mine. It creates a samskara, a subtle impression in our mind. All of those impressions collectively are the foundation for our habits, our personality. That is what we mean by our personal world. Everything which our ego has claimed as its own. And the amazing thing about it is that it's so subtle we don't even know that it's happening. We don't even know that we've created a world for ourselves, and that the way that we're experiencing the world in what we understand to be the present is so heavily influenced by what we've experienced in the past. All of those subtle impressions, all of those samskaras that the ego has worked so hard to create. So when this is what yoga is trying to help us see, that it's not that we are imprisoned or that we are at the mercy of the mind, but rather we have forgotten how powerful the mind is, and that when we don't engage with the world consciously, purposefully, everything's on autopilot. And that autopilot is largely governed by how we've already experienced ourselves to be, all of these conditionings of the kleshas and our samskaras. So our world can be never any better or any worse than the quality of our mind. So if we want the world to be beautiful, peaceful, and an opportunity for fulfillment and no more bondage, we need to transform our inner reality first, so that only the seeds of fulfillment are left, and anything which is binding, limiting, or painful within is transformed. That's the only world, only way that the world outside of us can be a source of beauty and joy. So we have to take responsibility for ourselves, is a simple way of putting it, and learn to be aware of what is inside of us if we want to be in a joyful, peaceful, beautiful environment outside, which is what everyone wants, of course. But we think that we have to work really hard outside and hold someone accountable outside of ourselves for all the problems that we see. And yoga is telling us that, no, start from within. And if everyone did that together, the world really would be free of all pain. The last thing I'll say about this yoga cosmology, all these different evolutions, because we didn't go through all of them systematically. That would be a little bit too much. But it's very clearly telling us that beyond the ego, there's something more. And that something more is the finest distillation of prakriti, of primordial nature. In a cosmic sense, it's called mahat, the cosmic mind. In a personal sense, it's called buddhi, our power of pure perception, faculty of discernment, intuitive discernment. And buddhi is a word that we've heard before in the path of yoga, perhaps. It's that finest aspect of the mind, which is the pulsation of pure consciousness. It's that light of consciousness which empowers every other aspect of our mind, and not just our mind, even our pranic awareness, our breath, our senses, and our body. This pulsation of consciousness that we can understand to be buddhi is the finest aspect of not only our personal world, but the finest aspect of creation. So it talks about a unique relationship between our buddhi and the cosmic mind, mahat, both which are essentially one and the same. It's simply that in our case, as an individual being, our ego, our ahamkara, it's like drawn a circle around a portion of mahat, if you will, a portion of this cosmic mind, and claimed it to be mine. That's our buddhi. If somehow we're able to experience our buddhi in a pure way without the influence of our ego, that's a state of freedom. And we'll come back to that. I'm kind of jumping ahead because I want to share the positive, inspiring aspect of this, because many parts of it are a little bit heavy. There's a lot of discussion on how we're in bondage. It's important to equally emphasize how we're free and why we're not always experiencing our freedom. This discussion of what comprises our objective reality is helping us to see what we're built of and why there are certain aspects of our world which bind us and certain things which free us. This finest expression of prakriti, primordial nature, is buddhi. Buddhi shines with the light of pure consciousness, purusha. So we talked about the union of the seer and the seeable. The union of purusha and prakriti, pure consciousness and primordial nature, or pure consciousness and the power of consciousness. What comes out of that? Buddhi. Buddhi is in a personal sense, and the word mahat is a cosmic mind. It is the essence of freedom and fulfillment. And it's not inert. It's dynamic, vibrant, aware. It's who we are. It's not just some static potential which is just waiting and waiting. It is so vibrant that it manifests in everything that we see ourselves to be and everything that we see in the universe. Purusha and Prakriti, as these fundamental, I wouldn't even call them principles, but as the nature of higher reality, they don't create our objective world, they become our objective world. So every aspect of our objective world is pervaded by Purusha and Prakriti. And that's what the idea of Buddhi or Mahat is trying to express. Extremely subtle, but all-pervading. Every aspect of the universe, in a cosmic sense, is pervaded by Mahat, this essential quality of pure awareness, but awareness which is highly vibrant and the very essence of fulfillment and freedom. Every aspect of our personal world, which we might consider to be our mind, but really is more than just our mind, it's our mind, senses, even our body and breath. All of that is pervaded by buddhi. When we can experience that, everything changes. What gets in the way? Our vrittis and samskaras that are propelled by the kleshas. Our roaming tendencies of the mind and all of our conditionings of the mind, both of which are propelled by our afflictions. That gets in the way. Seems very simple, but we need to have a more systematic way of knowing how to transform that conditioning. 220 through 227. So from here, one way of going about it would be, okay, I understand what the external world is all is built from the perspective of yoga, and I understand what my personal world is built from, all of these evolutes of Prakriti and Purusha. What do I do with that? But the Yoga Sutra spends 7 more sutras to really go in depth, to understand the nature of reality, and specifically how our objective reality, what is the relationship between our objective reality and higher reality? What aspect of Purusha and Prakriti, which you loosely might call divinity, perfection, pure consciousness and the power of consciousness, what does our reality have to do with that? It's very important to Patanjali to understand something about this. And these sutras here have a lot to do with the sutras that we studied in Samadhipada 123 to 129, where there is a really profound discussion on Ishvara. Ishvara being this higher reality that is the epitome of freedom. Freedom from all kleshas, freedom from karma, freedom from the outcome of all karma. That state of reality is Ishvara. So think about that again. A reality or a state of awareness that's free from all kleshas, free from karma, free from the outcome or experiences that come from our karma, and free from any repository of karma. That reality is called Ishvara. We just spent so much time talking about the kleshas and karma and the outcome of karma. Imagine if all that didn't exist. What kind of experience of reality would we have? That experience of reality is Ishvara. It's not God. It's a state of experience, which is why the word reality is used so often. To us, reality is reality because it's real, because we can perceive it, and because others have also perceived the same thing. Look at how the scientific method works. You have to see something at least twice independently for it to be real. Does that really make something real? Just because someone else has seen the same thing as I? And how do I really know that they saw the same thing? So I'm not trying to undermine the scientific approach too much, but that's not the kind of reality that we're talking about here. Reality is independently real because it is. And reality which is free and has been eternally free from any of these afflictions. Any influence of karma is Ishvara. That's what we're about to delve into. And the Shakti of Ishvara, the power of that kind of reality, the dynamic force that propels that reality into manifestation is Prakriti. They're not divinity in the sense of being a deity. They're the most essential qualities of perfection, which we term as higher reality. For the sake of study, over and over and again in this text, the word Purusha and Prakriti has been used. And in some cases, the word Ishvara is used in place of Purusha to be the quote-unquote special Purusha, because we are Purushas as well. We are sparks of consciousness. But the key difference is that we are consciousness, yet we're conditioned by our kleshas and by karma. Ishvara is not, which is why Ishvara is said to be the special Purusha. So keep all that in mind for the coming sutras. We'll go through these quickly. 220. The sheer power of seeing is the seer. It is pure, and yet it sees only what the mind shows it. The sheer power of seeing is Prakriti. It is one and the same as the seer, which is Ishvara. They're one and the same, the seer and the seeing power. And yet, in our experience, in our personal world, we are only able to see what our mind shows us. Our buddhi is that seed of consciousness that comes from Purusha. And yet, that buddhi is conditioned by the kleshas. It can only see what all the other aspects of the mind, namely our ego, show it. In fact, the ego is so powerful that it thinks it is the buddhi. Ego is so powerful that it thinks it is the source of its own power of consciousness. We create our own world. If it's going to get done, we're going to do it, otherwise it's not going to happen. I am the creator of my own future, no one else. And when I'm gone, everything's gone. This is very deep. Our ego is extremely subtle and very powerful because our buddhi is even more powerful. So this is, we studied the word avidya for a long time. This all-pervading cosmic ignorance. This is the fundamental expression of avidya. The buddhi forgetting that it is the buddhi. And it's not that the buddhi forgot, it's the totality of our mind, which comprises both buddhi and our ego and our senses, our karma. All of that, totality of whatever we are, we identify with our ego rather than with our buddhi. That is the root of avidya. And that's where avidya and asmita, this ignorance and distorted sense of self-identity, are intermingled. That is the distorted sense of self-identity. We think that we're experiencing our buddhi when in fact we're experiencing our ego. That's why, even though our buddhi, in essence, is pure, it only sees what the mind or the ego show it. We're basically, it's like we're not able to see what's in front of us. Someone hacked into that, and we're seeing what's in our screen of our mind. We're not seeing reality for what it is. We're seeing our own samskaras, actually. 221. The soul of the objective world, buddhi, is meant for purusha. So the word objective world is used again, just like we described earlier in Sutra 218, right? We talked about how the objective world is composed by the elements and the senses. Everything outside of us and inside of us is the objective world. All of that is made of these three properties of sattva, rajas, and tamas. And everything is imbued with this twofold purpose of fulfillment and freedom. The soul of this objective world is buddhi in our personal world. The soul of our personal world is our buddhi. Soul meaning the seat of our consciousness, our epicenter, our home base, the thing which puts everything else into context. It's interesting use of the term soul. It's whoever we are at our core. The thing that even if we forget where it is, it never forgets itself. It's our identity, the best part of our identity. It is meant for purusha. And one other way of translating it could be, this buddhi is to achieve the purpose of purusha. The finest aspect of our mind is meant to help us achieve the purpose of purusha, Ishvara. What is the purpose of Ishvara? It's exactly what we saw in 218, fulfillment and freedom. So we need to rediscover the soul of our world, which is our buddhi, not our ego. And as soon as we do that, and we genuinely know it, feel it, own it completely, we're able to allow this soul of our world to achieve its purpose, which is the purpose of Ishvara. In relation to one whose purpose is fulfilled, the objective world is destroyed. But in relation to others, it is not destroyed, for the objective world is common to all purushas. Sometimes, so there's purusha with a capital P and purusha with a lowercase p, if you will. We said that purusha with a capital P, which in Yoga Sutra is actually termed as purusha vishesha, the special purusha, is Ishvara. Consciousness, which has been eternally free from kleshas and karma. Purushas with the lowercase p are all of us as individual sparks of consciousness who have been conditioned by the kleshas and by karma. When one of these individual sparks of consciousness, when one individual being fulfills their purpose, and what is that fulfillment of purpose? Go back to 221. When we really identify ourselves as buddhi completely, rather than being partially identified with buddhi, but largely identified with our ego, our samskaras. When that happens, when we're completely one with our soul of our world, our buddhi, the objective world is destroyed. Does it mean that the whole world comes to an end? That's exactly what the sutra says. No. Because in relation to everyone else, there's still more to be done. And it doesn't mean that for that kind of being, for that kind of yogi, that the world will instantaneously disappear. It's the desire to define oneself in relation to the external world, that craving will be destroyed. That experience of avidya will be destroyed. This distorted sense of self-identity will be destroyed as soon as we are fully established in this experience of buddhi. For everyone else, it continues. And even for that being, the world is still there, but now it's no longer a source of bondage. It's an expression of freedom. The world doesn't disappear as soon as you reach samadhi. The world becomes more real. It's no longer a place of struggle, of bondage, or of pain. It's an infinitely vast field of opportunity, of joy. And the question of what comes next is something that never even enters that kind of yogi's mind, because there's such a clear connection to buddhi. And remember, buddhi is a personal, is our spark of a cosmic mind. There's complete resonance between buddhi and mahat, our personal awareness of consciousness and a more cosmic awareness of consciousness. And all of that, remember, is intrinsically imbued with twofold purpose, fulfillment and freedom. We're spontaneously and completely motivated to continue sharing that fulfillment and freedom. So our need to define this world in a particular way is destroyed. Our awareness of the world being bondage and limitation is destroyed, but the world continues to exist. Certainly for everyone else for whom this clarity of purpose hasn't been experienced, where the relationship is still a little bit muddled, that some of the relationship with the world is based on an experience of buddhi and some our own ego and samskaras. Definitely for everyone in that situation, it's real, and we know that it's real, and it's the only reality. For those who have found that deeper experience of buddhi, it's not the only reality. And that's what it means by being destroyed, that it's superseded by something much, much more essential. The term I keep using is a higher reality. Confusing sutra, just if you look at the literal translation. The cause of that union is ignorance. We're not talking about the union of Purusha and Prakriti. We're talking about the union that's described in 2:17. The union of the seer and the seeable is the cause of pain. 2:17. 2:24. The cause of that union, the union of, let's say, our personal consciousness and our personal world, our buddhi, and the world of our samskaras, is avidya. That's what brings these two together. That's what makes it so real. Avidya and all of the kleshas that unfold from avidya is the reason why this mistaken union between our limited world and our limited consciousness takes place. The union between Purusha and Prakriti is the exact opposite. It's vidya, not avidya. It's pure knowledge, pure purpose. So this sutra should not be read as the cause of the union of Purusha and Prakriti being ignorance. It's the exact opposite. This sutra really ties in very closely to the next one, in fact. Let me see if there's a couple notes I want to share. There's a very important phrase which is used in the commentary of 224. Viparya Gyan Vasana. This all-pervading, extremely subtle samskara of our distorted understanding. That is avidya. It is so subtle, but very simple, that we perceive ourselves to be consciousness, rather than realizing that we're experiencing the power of consciousness. There's a desire to own and possess, to limit. In fact, the amazing thing about this identification business is that identification is all about drawing boundaries, making things smaller, making sure I can hold on to them. It's the exact opposite of what realization is all about. That is that's one of the most fundamental samskaras, and it's such a deep samskara that it's called vasana, vipariya jnana, distorted knowledge, perverted knowledge. It's very deep. And from that comes a whole list of different forms of disempowerment that this sutra delineates in quite great detail. So, what's the cure to that? 225. From the absence of that avidya, that ignorance, comes the absence of mingling of consciousness with our mind. That is freedom, the absolute state of the power of seeing. When we're no longer under the influence of avidya and the kleshas, buddhi, pure consciousness, no longer sees itself completely commingled with the ego and all of the things that come out of the ego. The buddhi is able to see that it is the light of consciousness, or rather, it is like a lens through which the light of consciousness flows. And that power of consciousness is what brings our ego to life, is what makes our senses work, what allows our pranic capacity to energize us and our body to move around. Our body only works because it's empowered by our prana. Our prana only is empowered because our buddhi brings the pure light of consciousness to empower it. So this is a very simple sutra that carries forward. It ties back to the first book of Samadhipada and continues that if somehow we can decondition ourselves from these afflictions through practice, our buddhi will realize that it is distinct from our ego, our senses, and our body. Until then, all of them seem like they're one in the same. We don't know where one ends and the other begins, or if there even is a distinction. And leave the buddhi and the mind stuff behind for a second. Even our body, it's taken a few decades of hard work in the West for us to come to a point where we're fairly convinced that our mind is more than just a somewhat accidental byproduct of our neurology, that our mind is a living reality. And the reason why it took so long, and why there's still a struggle to fully understand what it means, is that they're completely commingled. They're completely enmeshed. Our physiology is completely pervaded by an energetic quality and by a deeper potential of our mind, which we might call consciousness. They're all connected, not just connected, interwoven in a very subtle way, very hard to tease out what all these different pieces are. And is there any other piece? One perspective is that it's not there. Why are you imagining something which isn't there? You know, we're a whole bunch of, you know, guts and flesh and tissue and this and that, and it works. You know, there's nothing there other than whatever is there. And that is a way of looking at it, which is somewhat prevalent, actually. Another way of looking at it is that, no, it is there. We don't have the sophistication of perception to understand it. Just because we can't perceive it doesn't mean that it's not there and that it's miraculously working. So, in the same way that we're not completely sure about the nature of consciousness and its relationship with our physiology, we're not completely sure if there's something that's called buddhi that is distinct from our senses and from our ego, from all of the ways that we've already understood ourselves to be. So it's not surprising. When we genuinely know that our buddhi is distinct, is independent, and is the source of the deeper source of power that brings our ego to life, that empowers our senses, our pranic capacity, let alone our body. A body is but the mere shadow of all of this, actually, and yet it's extremely real to us right now. Once we come to that realization, everything changes. That is freedom. That's the literal translation from 225. The absolute state of the power of seeing. The absolute state of buddhi. Power of seeing is the power of consciousness, the power of the seer, prakriti. 226. Unshakable discerning knowledge is the means of nullifying the misery resulting from the avidya-driven union of purusha and prakriti. So the question that comes from the last sutra is, how do we reach there? How do we transcend avidya and all of the pain that comes from it? The answer is given very directly here. Unshakable discerning knowledge. The word in Sanskrit is viveka khyati. Remember earlier, we talked about the word viveki, wise person, that for a wise person, all is pain. For a wise person, someone who is established in viveka khyati, all is pain when we are not established in this higher awareness. Any awareness which is conditioned by the kleshas is painful. That's exactly what that sutra was talking about, 217. Viveka khyati, unshakable discerning knowledge, is the means of nullifying the misery resulting from the avidya-driven union of purusha and prakriti. The avidya-driven union of our buddhi, our personal spark of consciousness, and our world, outside and inside. So, how do we reach viveka khyati? Before we get there, Sutra 227 says, his discerning knowledge has seven spheres. The furthest frontier is prajna. This is helping us understand that the experience of viveka khyati is a continuum. It's not an on or off state. It's not that work really hard, and all of a sudden, boom, you're there, and everything's taken care of. It's a continuum. We might touch there and then slide back a little. Or another way of looking at it is that we experience a little bit of viveka khyati as we begin moving towards it. Things become a little clearer, a little bit brighter. For the sake of study here, they talk about seven spheres, seven stages. And it's very important here to correlate this sutra to the extensive discussion of stages of samadhi that we looked at in the first book. We looked at the four stages of lower samadhi and then higher samadhi. There's a direct correlation here. When we talked about samadhi, the last two stages of lower samadhi were samadhi that's characterized by a state of pure joy and pure awareness. And beyond that was a transitional state called dharma megha samadhi, this experience of a cloud of virtue, dharma, sustainability, that leads us to higher samadhi, a state of freedom, a state of complete surrender where we're fully engaged to find our purpose. That's exactly what's being described here as the furthest frontier, being prajna. Prajna in the sutra is defined as the self-luminous field of consciousness filled with truth. That is what really defines viveka khyati, this unshakable discernment, this realization that we are pure consciousness, buddhi. That is the goal. From there, 228 begins a completely new section about how we reach Viveka Khyati through the practice of the eight limbs. So why is it that we didn't just jump to this, but went through all of these 10 sutras before? Because it tells us that the eight limbs are not just technique. There is a purpose behind them. We are trying to awaken our deepest potential. The eight limbs are a path that bring us towards Viveka Khyati, an experience of this unshakable state of discernment, where we are completely clear that we are buddhi. We're not intellectually convinced of it. Experientially, we have understood it. We've owned it. And that's why Viveka Khyati has several stages. It's definitely possible that, oh wow, I really felt it. And then something happens and some of our samskaras come in and we aren't completely sure. So Viveka Khyati is like an end goal, just like the word samadhi can either be the process or the state of realization. Viveka Khyati is both the process to reach there, which has many, many different steps. It's a continuum of experience and it's an end goal. The eight limbs help us walk on that path, help us awaken our connection to buddhi. Buddhi is ever awake. We have forgotten that it's there. We being that aspect of our mind which is completely identified with our ego, senses, and our body and everything outside of ourselves. Redefining that reality to be in the light of our inner reality rather than the other way around, which is how it is now. That's the path of yoga, and that's what will be the subject of our next session. Thank you.